I got one of those reports about a month ago, and it had all the Ashley Madison username and password. And of course, it was the buyer, the person that I was going to go meet with. And so I had to have that redacted from the report before we took it out there. So.
You're listening to the Help Me with HIPAA podcast, where HIPAA and humor collide to make learning fun. Your delightful hosts are Donna Grindle and David Sims. Relax. HIPAA help is on the way.
My name is Jeline. I'm from Atlanta, Georgia at the ENT Institute, and you're listening to the Help Me with HIPAA podcast.
Thank you for that intro, and welcome to the Help Me with HIPAA podcast. My name is David Sims of HIPAA for MSPs and Security First IT, and joining me is Donna Grindle of Carton. Good morning, Donna.
Good morning, David. Let's be all formal. We have a guest today.
I know. We have to, you know, be on our P's and Q's and any other letters we can find.
You definitely do.
I can't promise you anything. It's not likely to happen. But before we jump into our interview today with John Miller, which we've actually had him on before.
Long time ago.
Way back. Way back in episode 89, we had him in here. But we're going to talk about cybersecurity insurance or cyber insurance. Lots of questions around that. I don't know about you, but I hear people all the time talking about they can't find somebody who knows enough about cyber insurance to purchase it, or they have it and it doesn't work. So, you know, we'll be getting into a lot of interesting stuff about that today.
Yes, I'm excited.
Indeed. All right, cool. So where are you going to be coming up?
Well, I just turned in my official workshop for cybersecurity management for the SOMSA, Society of OMS Administrators National Conference, coming up in Savannah, April the 7th. I am very excited about that one. The nerd propeller spinning. But, you know, I think when this comes out, it'll be next week is our first boot camp, March boot camp. Mm-hmm. And you can still sign up for that if you're listening to it before March, 19th. I guess we'd take you on the 20th. Just show up. We'll take your money.
Yeah, we'll take you on the 22nd.
And then then we'll start gearing up for the May session, May 15th, 16th, 17th, the HIPAABootcamp.com.
So can you tell about the exciting news?
Oh, yes, I can. We have officially been pre-approved for CEU units from the Compliance Certification Board, which is the certification arm under the Healthcare Compliance Association. So we can get that certificate, which will help if you have other CEUs, and we'll be glad to provide information you need for others as well. But if you have a CHC or a CHPC or any of those others that come out of CCB, the CEUs are officially pre-approved. So come on in and get those CEUs done, because it'll be a nice big chunk with 3 days.
Man, that's a lot of acronyms.
I know, right? I love saying them.
Great. All right. So we're going to dive right into our interview today with John Miller. And John is with Sterling Seacrest Partners, and I will let him kind of introduce himself, and then we'll dive right into interviewing or interrogating or whatever we're going to do to him. Hey, John, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. I appreciate y'all having me today. By way of introduction, I'm actually a classic MedMal insurance broker. So grew up in the malpractice space and standard of care and all that kind of stuff with physicians. And what I've found myself over 25 years of doing this, and now I'm becoming more and more of a geeky IT insurance specialist. That's my background, and just a little bit about Sterling Seacrest. We're top 100 firm in the United States, brokerage with 7 offices in 3 or 4 states, and got about 200 people, and we're dedicated to physicians and surgeons, and got a team of about 30 of those 200. That's all we do is deal with issues that physicians and surgeons run into, and this is certainly one of them.
Nice. Yeah.
Welcome to the dark side of IT. Joining us. So I really, you know, I see John and Tammy, and I know you're back there, Tammy, so say hi.
Hello.
But I talk with these guys, you know, periodically because, you know, obviously we run in the same circle, so to speak. But, you know, there's always plenty of things for us to talk about. And I figured, yeah, it's about over 100 episodes since we talked to you last. And I believe things have changed a lot in that time frame as far as how people look at and what they expect from their cyber coverage. And I see a lot of confusion, and I was hoping that maybe we could try to clear a little bit of that up. So if you're game for that, John.
Sure. I may confuse it further, but I'm game.
Well, I want to know if you think it's changed a lot like I have, I believe.
Well, I think there's certainly more awareness. I mean, the underlying, you know, HIPAA high tech stuff's been around long enough. We should have gotten all this right by now. You'd think. I was musing on that this last week with one of my clients. We were talking about disaster planning and what do you do if your network's down and do you have the proper systems in place and all that kind of stuff. And she looked at me, she says, John, you realize that half my workforce has never worked on a paper record. Like if our system went down, I have to go and train these people how to interact with a paper record. And I thought, yeah, you know what? That's a good point. And I mean, it's, you know, I've been around long enough to see the evolution of this thing.
Yeah, that well, and now, you know, used to they would say, well, my cyber coverage is part of my MedMal, and that would be it. But now they're actually asking the question. Now, a lot of times we tell them to go ask a question, or you point out they need to know these things about what the policies actually cover and how much do I need and all of those kind of things. So I saw an article, you know, I've often mentioned Dark Reading is one of my favorite news sites for this stuff. And they had a great article about 10 costs your cyber insurance policy may not cover, which is, it only brought back to me that I really need to have you back on the show. So let's start with, how do you figure out how much you need when there's so many areas to worry about?
Yeah, that's a good question. So the first party aspects is actually pretty easy. And when I talk about the first party, let me be clear. So the insurance policies are designed to take care of first party expenses like breach notification, hiring the attorney, hiring the PR firm, hiring the forensic IT people, and doing all the notifications, ramping up a call center, your business interruption exposures associated with the downtime that you have, all the things that are truly first party costs. Those are actually fairly easy to evaluate. And it really comes down to cost per record. And we've had enough claims in the industry now that within $25,000 or $30,000 or $40,000, based on the number of records breached, we can tell you what the ultimate cost of the first party expenses are. The third party exposure around fines and penalties, obviously the government has, you know, requirements or limits on that. And so that part's easy to do. What the harder part to do is evaluate, you know, if some of these class actions that are working their way through, and I forget the name of the firm in Chicago, but they're kind of leading the industry in that. If they're successful in some of these class actions, that's the part that's harder to put our arms around. Because if they're effective and those are multi-million-dollar you know, circumstances, you know, our budgetary exposure on the first party expense is easy to calculate relative to those expenses, but the third party piece could be any, you know, many multiple millions of dollars. And so that's a lot harder to budget for.
Indeed, because those can get insane. So when you say first party, let me make sure that I'm following, is what you're talking about is the immediate expense of dealing with the breach itself, not all of the after effects, not all of the mudslide it may create, but the initial issues that it creates and dealing with that problem.
Well, yes and no. So, I mean, when I talk about first party expense, I mean the insured, the practice, the hospital, the nursing home, whoever is breached, what expenses are going to be funded out of their coffers, right?
Right.
That's the incident response piece, but it's also the ongoing credit monitoring services and other aspects and the continuation of that. It's just first party is the funding from our insured.
Okay. So you mentioned that it covers like forensics in most cases, those kind of things. And, you know, I know that we've had groups that come in and, oh yeah, we've got coverage. And then the minute that they had a data breach, they didn't know how to use the coverage. And the coverage turns out they had to use this special vendor, and it was only $50,000. And this special vendor made them use a specific attorney group. And then there were three attorneys on the first call, and they had like four calls in the first 2 days with those three attorneys, pretty much wiped out the $50,000.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't want people to feel like, oh, that's all I need. And so when you say you guys have kind of figured out that first party cost, which is, this is, in my mind, this is the least coverage you would get. This is the bottom, right? Is if you did that. And the Poneman Institute study last year said that in an average sort of way, the average cost per record in a healthcare breach is $408 per record. Are you seeing those kinds of numbers? I know you get, you know, secret sauce and stuff. I don't want to have you disclose things that are proprietary to you, but are those numbers like way inflated, or do you see that I guess they're looking at maybe more long-term than you are?
I would say those are grossly inflated. I mean, they're taking in brand hit and that kind of stuff that is not
right
quantifiable in dollars. They're also putting the maximum fines and penalties from the government. That's not in reality what we're seeing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just back of the napkin kind of general cost. So let's just say we had a breach and it was over 500 records, right? So we're going to have, a report to the data bank and all that stuff. Just high level, you're going to look between $3 and $5 for notification expenses, mailing all the letters, ramping up the call center, offering credit monitoring services. So $3 to $5 a record, okay, is a good budgetary number. And then on top of that, you're going to have attorney's fees, usually a minimum of about $40,000 to $50,000, and those can run up to $250,000. Okay, you're probably going to have, if it's a high profile practice, and most are, you're going to have PR expenses in the $75,000 to $125,000 range. Okay. And then the fines and penalties piece, usually you don't see much in the way of fines and penalties, particularly if it's a hacking event.
Mm-hmm.
If it's your third hacking event and you hadn't done anything to secure your system, you don't see fines and penalties.
Yeah.
But generally, you know, once somebody's hacked, they're actually the very best risk for us to insure, right? I want the practice right after they got hacked. Put everything in place. They've hired you guys to help. And they're a great risk from that.
So what about forensics?
Yeah, the forensic cost, depending on the nature of the breach,
mm-hmm.
you know, on the low end, you're going to be $30,000-$40,000. And on the high end, I mean, that can run, you know, several hundred thousand dollars. It just depends on how invasive it is and how much, you know, rebuild of systems you're going to have to do.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that can vary. But all of those, you know, we've got enough averages that you're not going to have the maximum of all of those in any given claim. And so, you know, we've got a pretty good feel. And there's some tools out there that we use. Some of it is proprietary, but some tools we use to kind of think about average cost per record. So, again, the biggest piece is we don't know what the third party, you know, class action suit is going to cost. Well, I can tell you what it's going to cost because I got one going right now. I mean, we're $250,000 in attorney's fees, and we're about 10 months into that case. So I'm anticipating we're going to be $400 to $450 when it's all said and done.
Yeah. Those are
attorney's fees.
Yeah. It's not the lost resources and all those kind of things,
right.
Which, you know, that is a point where you were saying the, you know, the downtime and that kind of stuff, you know, that you calculate in. I don't think people understand what a resource suck these things can be, and include that in their costs. What are you seeing on those?
Well, that's an interesting topic. And by the way, that's no different if you have a fire versus you have a data breach. So what is not reimbursed is the opportunity cost associated with taking your management team. And in the big breaches that I've had, I mean, the management team is distracted for about 2 months usually. Mm-hmm. Okay. Because by the time you call all the patients and manage all the call center and manage all the internal communication, all that, it just sucks all your time up for that 60 days. You don't get reimbursed for the taking your attention away from normal business challenges to deal with this stuff.
Right.
No different than if you had a fire and your management team had to think through all the, you know, getting your business up back up and running. That part's not reimbursed. What is reimbursed, though, are two things. Number one, the extra expenses that you incur from outside vendors, forensics, that kind of stuff, that are necessary for you to continue operations. And then you actually do get reimbursed for the loss of revenue, but it has to be loss of revenue specific to the event, not because it's a lost opportunity cost, right? Oh, you know, we had this big project. We were going to write this new account or take on this new deal, but we diverted our attention to this breach, and therefore we didn't get that new deal. You don't get to claim revenue that wasn't already in the door, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
You do get to claim the actual dollars of lost revenue that as a result of the breach.
Okay, so then David can tell you, because David's, for those of you who may not know, David runs he's a managed service provider company. And a lot of times people will try to say, well, we're going to include upgrades to our security, don't they, David?
Oh, yeah.
You know, so you've got the mitigation cost to correct the problem, and then you've got the cost to actually make sure you're showing not going to be that third breach person. You know, so I'm going to take action. And David, what kind of, you know, when you go in and see these scenarios when they haven't been doing these things, what kind of cost do you look at? You know, in a small practice, you know, 3, 4, 5 docs.
Oh, you talking about like during the incident or right afterwards when they're in remorse?
Well, we've already said that the things that are specifically dealing with the incident that are your bills, if you turn them in separately, those would be covered, right, John?
The bills associated with mediating the breach are covered, but it's just like your automobile. So if your right front tire gets hit in an automobile claim and you have the standard, you know, Chevrolet hubcap, you don't get to replace it with the gold hubcap. When you fix it, they're going to put the standard one back on. So yeah, all the additional things you buy after the fact are not covered.
So David, you know, I know going in, you know, you've got, okay, we're going to solve the problem.
Right.
And you and I know that varies widely.
Mm-hmm.
But now, what caused the problem is we didn't have a decent firewall, or we had one that wasn't up to date, and you haven't been on any kind of maintenance. You haven't been patching this long list of things. That's that line, though, right, John, where that mitigation isn't covered in most of these policies.
The corrective action that you took so that you don't have it again relative to new equipment and IT services that you really should have had in place that would have prevented it in the first place.
Yeah.
All that additional expense that you should have already incurred is not covered by the policy, correct?
Oh, yeah.
Right, yeah. So you're probably, I mean, for the size practice you mentioned, Donna, you know, I can't see it being less than probably 10 grand, you know, $10,000 to $20,000. And the difference in doing that up front is that you have the luxury of spreading that cost out. And a lot of times, you can also do multiple things at one time. And so you limit how much this is costing you when you have the time to deploy it properly versus we need to get all this done quickly.
Yeah. Cause do you guys get involved in advising people? You know, we all know that over 500, there's going to be an OCR investigation. They're at least going to ask you some questions. You know, OCR has made that pretty clear over the years. And as far as I know, they haven't really changed that policy. I have seen it take like a year before they give them a, hey, we want to know some stuff. So do you get involved with those attorneys, John? I mean, in that process as well?
Well, absolutely. So usually the obviously the attorney is going to prep for the visit, right? And have all of our ducks in a row from a documentation standpoint. But then the policies will usually also cover the corrective action plan that you need to do in response. And so you pick up both the investigation and in effect defense from the regulator, as well as those costs you incur on the corrective action.
Okay, so if the corrective action plan says I have to do a security risk analysis, which almost all of them do, is that what you're saying is covered in the corrective action plan?
Yes. Yep. Development of a HIPAA compliant, you know, security documents, compliance audits, any kind of assessment, implementation of training, all of that potentially is covered under the corrective action plan costs.
But that would have to be the corrective action plan that OCR put you under, not your own.
Yeah, it's the one you agreed to with OCR, correct.
So ironically, the things that you should do anyway aren't covered unless OCR makes you do it.
Correct.
And, okay, well, some of the people said, well, I'll just wait until I have a data breach and make insurance cover it. Well, it's a long process, you know, but okay, it's a way. What about your patients, you know?
And the bigger thing is twofold. Number one is the brand, right? I mean, I can't tell you how impactful a privacy breach is, particularly in a smaller community where the local newspaper will get a hold of you and make hay of it as a headline grab, but also just the reputational risk that you have with your other referring physicians, right? I mean, they don't want to be referring to the guy that's had multiple breaches.
Yeah.
So there is a revenue component to this. Now, the hard part is measuring that loss of revenue. Mm-hmm. And that's where you get the forensic IT people or forensic accounting people in play. But it's just good business to tighten all this stuff up because you don't want that distraction. You want to be able to execute on all the other initiatives you have.
Yeah. I mean, it's a huge, that approach that, you know, I know David and I both heard it, that, well, you know what? I'm not going to worry about it. I'll just wait until it happens and insurance will cover everything. Then why I don't have to. That's just as reckless as I'm not going to have car insurance because, you know, I never have an accident. Well, actually, it's more than that because they're saying I'm going to insure like 50 times what the cost of my little 1987 Hyundai is worth.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, we hear that when we're talking about cybersecurity and things that should put in place to protect themselves. And there are times we hear people say, well, I have insurance to cover that. So why do I want to pay up front monthly when I can just claim it on my insurance when it happens?
Which brings us perfectly around to the amount of vetting that you guys do when you're, you know, setting these policies up. If the application says, have you done a security risk analysis? And they say, yes. Do you just take their word for it? And is there any implication if they haven't really done one?
Well, the underwriters very rarely take your word for anything. they want to see it. They want to see the documentation of it. And if you've had a prior breach, you know, they'll be a little more invasive in terms of the remedial steps that you took subsequent to the breach. You know, unfortunately or fortunately, you know, a lot of our customers never had a breach. And so there's not a whole lot of documentation other than the standard underwriting questions. Do you have this, that, or the other? And there's a lot of yes or no in that. But if you've had a breach, yeah, they're going to ask for the what you did in the aftermath of it and maybe even, you know, what your corrective action plan was and all that stuff. I mean, that's the underwriter's job.
So you're less likely if they haven't had a breach to really push, though.
No, that's correct. So what's interesting is some of the underwriters have taken what I call a boiler machinery approach. And let me explain that to you for a second. So if you have a boiler in a hospital and it has the risk of explosion, one of the things you get with your boiler machinery policy is an inspection of the boiler. And Hartford Steam Boiler historically has been the party that's done more boiler inspections than anybody else in the world. And the idea is, you know, we're going to kind of make sure we don't have this risk, right? So that concept has made its way to cyber liability insurance and underwriting in that they will do several penetration tests. They'll do some white hat hacking as a part of potentially, depending on the size of the group, as a part of the underwriting process so that they know what the vulnerabilities are. And in effect, that's a value add to the customer because they're getting a little bit of that, you know, risk valuation on the front end of it, even before they even purchase the product.
Yeah. I mean, I would be using that in my compliance documentation. You know, here, I want a copy of those reports so I can put it in my compliance documentation. That way I'm documenting somebody looked.
One of the companies actually runs a pretty invasive dark web search where they look for username, password, that kind of stuff.
And just a quick aside, because you'll find this funny. So I got one of those reports, and this is not a healthcare practice, but another business. I got one of those reports about a month ago, and it had all the Ashley Madison username and password. And of course, it was the buyer, the person that I was going to go meet with. And so I had to have that redacted from the report before we took it out there. So.
Yeah, we do those as part of our assessment. And sometimes you're like, oh, man, I don't want to give this to them. It's not pretty sometimes, isn't it, David?
I don't look.
Yeah, just hand it over.
Just hand it to him here. You figured out.
I don't want to know. La, 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 la.
Exactly.
But we have a lot of cases where and you guys know, when we go in, you know, we're turning over all the rocks and lifting up the covers and looking under everything. And we found many cases where when we start asking questions, we can say, clearly, you've never done a security risk analysis. But I have cyber coverage, and on my application, I said I had.
Mm-hmm.
And we see that a lot. And I know that in some cases is they truly don't understand what a security risk analysis is. You know, they think it's somebody checking to see if they have the policies and procedures required by the security rule, which is not a security risk analysis. And I know that there are cases out there, and as far as I know, none of them have actually the payer hasn't won, if you will, but they're starting to push back and say, look, you said you've done this and then you didn't and you had a data breach. Is that something that you think is going to become more prevalent, or are you just going to be vetting more on the front end?
It will become more prevalent as the dollars continue to increase. Look, fraud is fraud. If you ask a question and you don't answer it forthrightly, naivete relative to the question is not an excuse. You have to answer questions posed to you in good faith. And anybody that is filling out the application and is that naive is paying money to an insurance carrier that likely will deny the claim.
So, yay, affirmative defense does not work with OCR or with you. And I think that's important for people to understand, because they'll come out and tell us, well, my MedMal or my E&O or my whatever, you know, whether it's a business associate or a covered entity, they'll say, I'm already covered, cyber's in there. And I don't know how to get them to understand that there's a difference between cyber coverage and having a little clause that covers parts of cyber, isn't there?
Well, there absolutely is. I mean, that little starter limit that you get with most of the malpractice carriers of $50,000, typically it's 50. I mean, you know, that's going to get you about a week, right? Maybe two.
2 days in some cases, is what I saw.
You know, one of our recent breaches, the PR firm alone for the first month was 50 grand, right? And so, you know, it just doesn't get you very far. And you know, the malpractice carriers are trying to do the best they can to offer an affordable, you know, starter limit, if you will, to raise awareness relative to this.
Right.
I would tell you that most of our clients, probably more than half now, are carrying a separate $1 million policy or more, depending on the size of the group. And one of the reasons you do that is the turnkey aspect of when you do have a breach, you've got a built-in team. And so you mentioned that earlier, and that's a really good thing to talk about. One of the, I guess, the bigger your organization is, the more susceptible you are to a breach and the more brand impact that breach has. And so just like, and I'll use an analogy for the physicians, just like when physicians are buying malpractice insurance from me, they ask me, tell me about the defense counsel. What's their record? How well do they do in defending cases? Who are they? I'd like to meet them. I'd like to talk to them before I go with this particular malpractice carrier. The folks that are buying this stuff need to be asking those same questions. Who is the IT forensics firm? Who are the people that are going to ramp up the call center? You know, what is the team behind the product that I'm buying? Because when it happens, I don't have 3, 4, 6 weeks to build my team. I got to act.
Right.
And one of the things we do to help clients in that is what I call tabletop exercises, where I say, all right, you just had a breach. It was 700 people's names, and here's what you know. Now, what are we going to do, right? And have the people, the IT folks, the consultants, the legal folks in that particular group all sitting at the table and said, all right, well, we need this, you know, these following things. Well, why don't we go ahead and write our communication plan for that breach? I mean, there's no sense in us drafting it at the time. Here's a sample, adapt it for your particular practice and have it on the shelf and ready to go, right? And so that's proactive stuff that we're doing with clients.
Preach it, brother. Preach it. That's what we say too. I love it because, I mean, this is exactly, I mean, one of the things that we do in our HIPAA boot camp is, you know, we really push the requirement of an incident response plan. And not, you know, not only does HIPAA require it, but any other formal cybersecurity program that you have is going to say you need to have a plan. And it doesn't matter if it's 500,000 patients or one patient, things happen. And you've got to know what you're going to do because you end up, A, spinning your wheels, wasting time, and B, making mistakes because you haven't sat down and thought that through. And one of the big things that we added to the boot camp with our third day is a workshop that specifically deals with writing incident response plans. And it is one of the things that people don't get more than anything else I see. And having one is night and day, at least from my experience.
Well, what's interesting is I talked to the PR folks, and one of the PR firms we used actually handled the Home Depot breach. And so, you know, that was at the time, if you think back now, and of course, now we've had Yahoo and all the bigger breaches, but at the time... Yeah. I mean, that was big news. That was kind of a shock to corporate America that even that could happen and the brand hit. And one of the things that they learned through that process is time to market, time to notification, right? And the quicker you are on the notification, the less conspiracy theories you have around, well, you didn't act in the consumer's best interest, right?
Right.
And so their rule of thumb is you've got about 7 to 10 days. And once you get past 7 or 10 days, your brand starts to take a bigger hit if you delay notification past that. And so that's not a whole lot of time.
Wow.
You know?
No. It takes longer than that in some of these cases, even figure out what happened.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
You know? So that is pretty intense. And I think it's important for people to start to grasp what that really means in healthcare. So many people assume in healthcare, well, I've always been their doctor and I'm the only one of these for 20 miles, so I don't have to worry about it. But I think there's a bigger thing there. And the vendor thing, I think, is also very important that you touched on is what, you know, I know some of the policies say you absolutely, for this policy, have to use this vendor for all your incident response. And in cases where they're my clients, they want me holding their hand through the whole process. Okay, well, my bill's not going to be covered for that because I'm not one of that vendor's consultants. But I'm going to have one of their consultants on the call too. And, you know, it's like, you must use these people and you must do this and you must do that or it's not covered. How much of that really happens?
Well, it happens more and more. So in the advent of about the time we were doing our last podcast, you know, it was still relatively at the discretion of legal counsel to build the team, right? The IT forensics, the PR, et cetera. Mm-hmm. That really has changed in just this limited amount of time. And it's largely changed because there have been enough of these activities now that they're seeing who does a good job and who does a bad one. And listen, they're footing the bill. So I don't blame them a bit for aligning the team. But I'll give you a couple of things clients can do, particularly if they have a trusted advisor like you are. They can build into their insurance program you being a part of that team. And, of course, you know, the carrier's going to want to know what your rates are and all that kind of stuff, but they actually can write into the plan the team that you want. And I'll give you an example. We have, I can't say their name, but one of the largest IT companies in the Southeastern United States is a client of ours. Mm-hmm. And we write specifically into their cybersecurity plan, the legal counsel that we're going to use, the IT forensic counsel that we're going to use, and the carrier has in effect pre-blessed those. Now, the little small practice may not have the leverage to be able to do that, but the bigger you are, certainly you have that leverage. And by the way, there might be a price point associated with that because, you know, if Donna's $1,800 an hour, and the other people are $300 an hour, then, you know, there might be a premium charge on that.
$1,800 an hour. I got sick just thinking about trying to tell somebody that was my fee.
Totally worth it.
I would never even be able to get that out without laughing. So, but that is one of the things that to me is important to have in your incident response plan is to understand what that means. And you should know that going into your policy. And just as a side note, Tammy, you'll be hooking me up, right? But the most important part of some of the incident response plan is just understanding who you can use, how you initiate the claim, how long is it going to take. You know, if I learn about an attack on Saturday night, or like some of these folks on Christmas Eve, then what do I do? Am I going to wait until everybody's back at work on Monday? Or do I have the ability to, you know, David's my IT provider. I need to mitigate the problem. And if that's not going to be covered, what am I going to do? Because David's going to have to pay his people to be in on Christmas Eve and Christmas Day.
Mm-hmm.
And David is $1,800 an hour.
Yeah, I am.
So all of those things are things you would learn if you sat down. Well, and I know there's a difference if you just like working with a broker like you guys is different than I, you know, call up ABC company, give me a policy and I'm done, because y'all work differently as being that broker, right? Your services are different.
Well, I mean, we take on the mantle. The very definition of broker is that you represent your client's interest, not the insurance company's interest. And so, we take on the mantle of it. We're almost like, think of it like a buyer's agent in real estate, right?
Yep.
We look at it from the client's viewpoint through their lens. So,
yeah, that's why we encourage people to always use somebody that can evaluate it intelligently and not just tell you what you need to buy from us. So, and a big thing that we do in our business is make sure everything we do, we can point it back to, you know, this is why we do it this way. So it becomes a bigger thing. So just, I know we're running low on time, and I wanted to get in another piece that we see happening in the States now. There's more and more conversation about it, are these safe harbor laws that say, you know, if you can prove you are doing a cybersecurity program, then we're going to let you have safe harbor when it comes to these third-party lawsuits. Thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, that's not foreign to the whole tort claim evaluation in other areas. And the best analogy that is easily relatable to for physicians is, there's the concept that if you met the standard of care, that you shouldn't be negligent for the bad outcome that happened to the patient. I mean, bad outcomes don't necessarily mean negligence. And so what you're talking about in safe harbor is establishment of a standard of care, said in another way. I think the challenge of that, and it'll be interesting to see how some of the states deal with it, is that the ball's always moving. Right. So what the standard of care, and this is true in medicine too, what the standard of care is in 2019 may be different than what the standard of care is in 2022, because the technology moves that fast. Right. So, you know, we didn't have dual authentication 10 years ago, but everybody has that now. Right. And so not judged based on what was potentially available. You're judged on what the standard was. And so the challenge of those laws is that you can't really codify what processes you needed to have in place. You need to have an independent body that keeps up with what is reasonable, usual and customary, if you will. You know, and until we have a nationalized standard, I think those cases will be very interesting to follow, because it's always a moving target.
Yeah. Well, you know, a lot of people say, well, if you just had HIPAA certification, and that alone is so complicated, we talk about there's no such thing as HIPAA certification, and it's because it is such a moving target. But defining HIPAA as a standard of care creates a really risky world for all of those providers out there. Oh, well, I'm going to define HIPAA is a standard of care. And, you know, essentially, if I'm doing this, I'm not negligent. Well, everybody that doesn't do it needs to be aware, because now that's opening you up. We're saying this is the standard of care. If you're not doing it, it makes you more liable, is what I believe will happen. Any thoughts on that?
I think that's absolutely the case. I mean, one of the things, there's a reason that the medical societies don't come out with a document that says this is the standard of care, right? mean, you don't go to the Urological Society and there's a document that says this is the standard of care. It's just what is usual and customary. And so as you start thinking about what is usual and customary in that, and by the way, it can change, right? Because what's usual and customary for IBM is going to be different than the little dermatology practice in down near the Okefenokee Swamp, right? I mean, they're just different. They're different worlds. And I think that's the challenge when you start to say, all right, well, you know, what's that standard going to be? Because it does need to vary based on industry type and size and resources and all that kind of stuff.
What's reasonable and appropriate in your environment?
Right.
IBM worries about bugs. The dermatologist down by the Okefenokee worries about skeeters.
No doubt.
That's definitely the case. So we've had a great conversation. Thanks for being on with us, John, because these are so very important for people to think about these things in their business, whether it's healthcare or not. You need to be thinking about this today in any size business. There's statistics that say 60% of small businesses will go out of business after a major data breach.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I don't know that I necessarily think that's a hard stat. It's, I think, kind of older. But still, it's one to be concerned about when you look at over 50% of the data breaches we see, and we know this, are with small businesses. And generally, you've got the big IBMs and the Equifaxes and all of those, and they're insured out the wazoo, I assume. But the smaller folks, those are the ones that are our target. And I don't know that they really are looking at this yet as seriously as they should. But I know they are looking at it more now than they ever have.
Yeah.
So is there anything that you think we should be, you know, sharing with them to say, look, this is important for you to evaluate to protect your business and the things that we should be looking at? Yeah, that $408 a record, I think it's kind of high. And if you look at the number of records, you know, most doctor's offices have on file, that just like, well, we'll close up shop kind of thing. But, you know, down at the bottom end, it was like 125.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're not looking at, go with 125, do something and know it. So what's the best advice if they're really having trouble either getting the concept down and not just relying on MedMal to get over the hump and really focus on these?
Well, if you're going to justify your $1,800 an hour, Donna, what I would tell you, the best advice you can give a client these days is around the vendor management. I mean, we see more claims popping up from vendors being hacked and then them coming back through to the practice. And the whole analysis of the business associate agreement, putting insurance requirements in the business associate agreement, making those insurance requirements have teeth for indemnification. One of the things that's often missed, and think of this for a second. So let's just take, and I won't name a name, but let's say one of the largest EMR providers in the country gets hacked. Okay. And by the way, that's not too far afield. I mean,
No, it's not.
And you happen to be a subscriber to that particular EMR service. So let's say you put $1 million requirement on them that they carry $1 million of cyber breach coverage to pay, because it's really their negligence, right? They should be paying all your notification costs, all the cost that you have associated with dealing with it as the covered entity. Well, do they have enough insurance? Because if every one of their customers is hacked, do they have $1 million times however many customers do they have? Heck no, they don't. I mean, nobody would buy that much insurance, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things you need to think about is requiring the vendors to have agreement-specific limits. That is, I'm going to be fine that you got a $20 million cyber policy, but I want $5 million dedicated to me, mm-hmm. and I want your insurer to agree to that.
right? So then I put the insurer on the risk to cover my $5 million to, in effect, isolate it from the rest of the customers that are hacked. That's where we're headed. And there, you know, that's going to have to be pushed by industry, but it's absolutely the right answer for your clients. So that'll get you that justification for 1800, I'm sure.
Well, you know, I could tell you though, you know, this goes back to, you know, IBM could probably require that from their vendors, but the dermatologist is not going to have a chance getting the EMR provider to do that when it's a, you know, one or two doc shop. And so we're in this vicious cycle of, you know, where does it all fall? And we are absolutely, I mean, one of the predictions we had for this year is how important the supply chain management is going to really, you know, become. And people are really starting to get it for exactly the reason that you're talking about, is that liability. Because I wouldn't begin to tell you how many vendors we've vetted who've been told they don't need to worry about a data breach. It's the responsibility of the covered entity.
Right.
And it's absolutely one of the things that worries me the most. And people don't get how important that is to vet those vendors and make sure that they have that kind of coverage. I mean, if the entire company is, you know, worth $100,000, you know, I'm being crazy there, but if the whole company is worth less than what the data breach cost you, you've got to be aware and make sure those people are doing the right thing. I'm not saying don't use that vendor. I'm saying stay on top of that vendor.
Yeah, and I, just a quick little very practical tip. Just asking to be an additional insured, that term, additional insured, on the policy that your vendor has, at least gives you access to that policy, right? And in the absence of that, if you rely upon indemnification provisions and all that kind of stuff, they're only as good as the honorability of the person behind them, right? But if you're an additional insured on an A-rated insurance company's policy, you got teeth, because you can go to your insurance commissioner in your state and say, you know, gosh, make them perform, right? And so that stuff alone, there are a lot of people still missing that piece.
I love it. That's perfect. So what else do you think we should have talked about that we didn't?
Social engineering is probably the biggest, hottest topic right now. And I'm going to give you the 45-second version if I can. So theft of money from your practice by your employees is a covered employee dishonesty claim, because it's a dishonest act by your employees.
Yep.
Your employees wiring money to somebody who tricked them into wiring said funds is not covered by your employee dishonesty policy, because that is not a dishonest act of your employee. They honestly thought they were sending it to the right person. They just got duped. Okay.
And
social engineering is something that a lot of people still haven't heard of, but it's absolutely something they need to be asking their insurance provider for. And it's that concept of, I want to protect against my employees being tricked with departing with my own funds.
And David's wife worked at a company where that actually happened. So we've brought that up a couple of times, because people don't understand that happens more often than you would like to know about.
Well, we just had a large practice in our geography depart with over $200,000 to a normal vendor that they used all the time. And the bad guys were able to impersonate that vendor and just change the routing number. So we didn't have a system in place to verbally verify the check, and we sent the money and poof, it was gone.
Yeah.
Wow.
And that is not covered unless you've got social engineering coverage.
All right. And we talked about that, I think it was last week, Donna, where one of my clients received an invoice, you know, from my company. It looked like it was, but it wasn't. Right.
Yeah. It's not the Nigerian prince approach anymore. They're getting pretty sophisticated.
they're getting better. The more we do, the more they do.
All the princes are gone.
Right.
They all got their money.
Well, this whole conversation, just to me at least, points out that the prevention piece is so critical, so that you avoid all this complexity and cost that we've talked about, or at least try to.
Well, and if you do enough prevention, it does mitigate a lot of this cost. And you're able to, you if you know you've got the logs and you know you've got the documentation that the forensics people can work from, that's way cheaper than them having to figure everything out themselves. You know, so there's a lot of things that being prepared saves you money in the long run.
Well, it's interesting you say that, Donna. So I have a little slide that I use with all my customers that there are three things you can do with risk. You can avoid it, you can mitigate it, or you can transfer it, right?
Mm-hmm. You can ignore it.
I live in the transfer world, and that's how I make money. But the value add that we give is the ability to either avoid it and mitigate it. And unfortunately, there's not a whole lot you can do to avoid it. The hackers are out there. Your own employees do stupid stuff. You know, the avoidance is a real challenge in this particular area. Not like, you know, I can avoid automobile liability by not getting in a car, right?
Yeah.
you can't really avoid it in this space, but there are lots of things you can do to mitigate it. And then after you've done all the mitigation, only transfer that risk that you can't get your arms around.
And that's where we come in.
Well, there's a fourth option. You can ignore it.
Yeah, that's
unfortunately what many people do.
Yeah, we see that a lot too. So, John, what about, I have every so often somebody will ask me, they'll call up and say, I'm looking at cyber insurance. Is there something that you can do for me that would help me get a better rate? And I'm like, I don't know. You have to ask your insurance person, but is that a thing?
Yes and no. So there's an expectation that you would have, back to our standard of care, there's an expectation that a good-sized practice, a 4 or 5-person practice, would have some appropriate IT infrastructure to prevent, breach. The bigger thing that you guys can help them with is actually the training aspect of what Donna does in training. And we find that of the dollars expended for claims, preventable claims, we feel like 80% of those dollars would have been, or 80% of the claims would have been avoided if we had appropriate training, right? And so there's certainly some training that you can do. There are, I won't call them discounts. It's basically you don't get rated up if you have appropriate IT infrastructure, not as simple as this, but it used to be, make sure they had a firewall, make sure they had a dual authentication, that kind of stuff. The more they have, the better you're able to negotiate the rate down, but it's not dollar for dollar. It's not like, all right, well, I just implemented dual authentication and therefore I get a 5% discount on my premium. It doesn't work that way. Mm-hmm. But the better you can help your client put forth, it's almost like a loan package with a bank, right? I mean, if you go to the bank and you've got a napkin and you say, I want to borrow $100,000 and here's my business plan, they're going to say, no thanks, right? You come in with a 45-page professional looking document, they're going to go, oh yeah, here's your $100,000, right? It's the same concept in insurance.
Okay.
So documentation, just saying. We mention that all the time.
Yep.
Well, John, we could probably keep talking for another hour. We're having such a great time with you, but we do try to limit our podcast. So, we may have to have you back soon, but we greatly appreciate your time. I know that you're a busy guy and can't thank you enough for being here. You want to make sure that you give everybody your contact information and any parting thoughts?
Yeah, absolutely. So you can reach me at jmiller@sspins. So that spells S spins, but it's sspins.com. Or my phone number is 678-424-6503. And be happy to answer any questions. I get a lot of questions, just general questions from the public. Well, usually if I don't know the answer, at least I can get you in the right place.
There you go. You just got to tell him you heard about him on Help Me With HIPAA.
There you go.
All right. Well, share us out, everybody, because this will be a good one. And I'm really looking forward to getting the feedback we'll get from folks on all the great conversation and information we had. Thanks, John and Tammy, too. Appreciate you guys more than I am appropriate in being able to thank you in business. I try to send you what I can, but you know where I am.
Appreciate it.
All right, folks, that is our show for today. Remember to follow us and share us out. I know I'll be sharing this one out to, I got a few people already in mind I'm going to be sending it to.
All right.
Oh, absolutely. Rate us on your on our podcasting app. We need your help to spread the word. Always remember to send in your questions and ideas at contact@helpmewithhippa.com. And remember, for Donna and myself, and we'll throw John in there too, HIPAA is not about compliance or insurance. It's about patient care.
You've been listening to the Help Me with HIPAA podcast, hosted by Donna Grendel and David Sims, the show created to help you with HIPAA. For more information or to ask us a question, visit our website at helpmewithhippa.com. Neither Donna Grendel or David Sims are attorneys, and they do not offer binding legal advice concerning regulatory compliance. The information in this podcast should not be relied upon or construed as legal advice in any way. Consult your attorney for legal advice concerning compliance with HIPAA regulations.